Today on the Nerd Outcast podcast, we boldly go where no man has gone before as we talk about Star Trek. I'm your host, Chris Passion, and today we're going to discuss Gene Roddenberry's 1960s Star Trek. We're talking about the original series. We're not talking about the movies, any of Next Generation, Deep Space Nine. This is the original adventures of the original crew, Captain Kirk and company, of Star Trek. As is typical for this podcast, I brought on some experts to help me discuss Gene Roddenberry's classic television sci-fi series. Let me go on and introduce them. My first expert immediately to my right is
Kitten McCreary.
Hello, Kitten.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you back. This is your second podcast.
So. It is. It's my second podcast with you.
You've been cheating on me?
All the other podcasts everywhere. I'm a dirty, dirty podcast girl.
Just remember, if you are on one podcast, then you've been with every other podcast that other people on that podcast have been with.
That's
how internet viruses spin, right?
Kitten, you're a Star Trek fan, right?
I am.
Okay. I'm assuming none of us were alive when this originally aired. Unless we all look amazing for our age. Okay.
I'm on the edge.
You've seen the original series?
I have.
Have you seen all 79 episodes?
I have.
Ooh. Cool. Well, hold on to that. We'll come back to it as we discuss the show. My next expert sitting right next to me is
Pete Novice.
Hello, Pete.
Hey.
It's early in the morning. I can't.
It's really early.
I can't talk. It's not even really that early. It's like 10:30. But
it's early for like a bunch of actors and people who don't do this. I don't get up in the morning.
Fair enough. Pete, have you seen all 79 episodes?
Yes, I have. In fact, just recently I felt like I was lacking in my nerd credentials as a Star Trek fan, so I needed to just sit down and watch them all.
There's nothing wrong with that. Cool. Hold on to that. We'll come back to it. So my final guest for today, my outcast, who knows, I'm assuming, nothing about Star Trek somehow, sitting across from me is...
Hi. My name's Mark Soloff.
Hey, Mark.
I wouldn't say I know nothing about Star Trek, but I'm certainly not an expert in the original series.
Let's spend a little time with you, Mark.
Yay!
Let's learn about you.
All right.
Before we talk about Star Trek. Are you a Star Trek fan?
I appreciate some aspects of Trek. I've watched, since the advent of Netflix streaming, I've watched a lot of different series. I'd say I like it, but I'm not a fan. If that makes sense. I'm not fanatical about it.
Are you a Star Wars fan?
Yeah.
Ah, you're in the Star Wars camp.
Space magic.
What about... Yeah, I mean, that's pretty apt. What about Battlestar Galactica?
Oh, yeah. Well, the new Battlestar, I was a huge fan of.
Oh, yeah.
During its series. Original Battlestar.
Not
I can
so much.
Do without, sorry.
We can't be friends, Mark. I'm learning this more and more.
Any other science fiction? The Matrix?
I liked The Matrix. I liked the first one. I like the works of William Gibson.
Okay.
I love zombie stuff.
Yes.
Walking Dead, I'm a big fan of. I like many different sci-fi series.
Okay.
I love video games. But original Star Trek, not so much my cup of tea.
All right.
I don't hate it, but it never stuck to my ribs.
Okay.
Is an expression I heard recently, which disturbs me.
Have you seen an original episode of Star Trek?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember what it was about?
Yes. I saw Trouble with Tribbles.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Just from pulling from the memory banks of that Mighty Mark computer, do you remember, like, impressions about the show? Like...
So, and this is, I cheated a little bit. I watched the beginning of that episode this morning in preparation for today's cast.
That's cheating.
Is it cheating? Is an outcast not allowed to have any knowledge of the community it was outcast from?
No, I thank you for researching. Go on ahead. Go ahead.
Like, Napoleon, you're banished. Forget about France. I just compared
that
myself
was
to Napoleon. Anyway, it seems very dated. It doesn't age well. You know, everything is very, like, 60s, 70s kind of Technicolor, what do you call it, polyester uniforms. All the women have to wear, like, these miniskirt dresses. All the men have this weird, like, kind of high pants sensibility sucking in their guts.
Okay.
What's not to love?
And I think there's a huge nostalgia factor for stuff like Original Trek.
Okay.
Where people were young when they watched it, or you know, they saw it come out for the first time and it was new and really different. And so there's a lot of that love that gets carried over when they watch it now. And so it's like you're looking at your old bag of a spouse after 40 years of marriage, and you still see, like, the young person that they were when you fell in love initially.
You're single, right?
No!
You will be, right?
Okay.
After this podcast.
Cool. Alright, we'll talk about whether it holds up or not, but alright, I was curious if you had seen it or not. Anything else we should know about you as a nerd? You mentioned science fiction. Do you delve into fantasy also, like Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, I like fantasy stuff. I like Lord of the Rings, but I think I prefer other fantasy properties, especially in video game form. I loved Dragon Age. I think in general, I prefer sci-fi
versus
more than fantasy.
Okay, cool. That was going to be my next question. Let's see if we can convince Mark that Star Trek holds up, or if we can convince ourselves that Star Trek holds up. Just a quick little history lesson. Star Trek was created by Gene Roddenberry. It aired from 1966 to 1969, 79 episodes. Gene Roddenberry originally pitched this as a wagon train to the stars, and if my research is correct, Gene Roddenberry had done a lot of writing for television, specifically for westerns, up until that point, and westerns were a big hit in the 50s. When he came along with the idea of Star Trek, he wanted something adventurous, but set in a science fiction setting, but still
Firefly?
Yeah. A couple of interesting notes about Star Trek. They originally pitched the show, and the network turned it down, saying it was too cerebral. But they liked the idea. So I forget which network it was. I think it was... Was it NBC? It might have been NBC.
That sounds right.
They said, we like the idea, so they gave Roddenberry permission to do a second pilot. So he did a second pilot, and the network picked it up.
Yeah. Well, and, like, Lucille Ball actually, like, said, like, no, I think this can be a good show, and we should produce it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just to give it a little bit of context, do you guys know any contemporaries that Star Trek would have been up against? I know they were up against Lost in Space in the 60s. Was Twilight Zone or...
I think Twilight Zone was earlier than that.
Okay.
Because, I mean, that's a lot of black and white.
Okay.
Yeah, Twilight Zone started earlier than that, but of course, like, it lasted a lot longer because it had a ton more contributors and things like that.
Right.
And some of the contributors from Twilight Zone actually went and did Star Trek episodes.
Was Flash Gordon running?
I think Flash Gordon was a later 60s, early 70s.
Okay. Like, it was probably a comic book at the time.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it was later made into the movie and stuff like that.
Okay. So, let's talk about the show. Yeah, where do you guys have a specific starting point that you want to jump on with this?
Space. The final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise.
I'll pull out a couple of quotes real quick. The show was unusual in its serious discussion of contemporary societal issues in a futuristic context, unlike Lost in Space, which was more campy in nature. I would argue that there's a lot of camp in Star Trek, but I never watched Lost in Space.
No, that one where they're all mind-controlled and they're, like, dancing for the entertainment of the powerful aliens.
That works. That works. And another thing about this show, during its run, Mark, it was... Mark, just so you know.
I'm listening.
Hey, listen up. The show was nearly canceled almost every season. Like, it was a struggle to get the show back on. And the fans were just in love with the show. And not just, like... One thing that the network loved about the show was, I think it attracted young viewers. I know it attracted, like, scientists, doctors, people that the network considered highbrow, and they loved that. So they kept renewing the show, at least for the obvious three seasons that it was on. Then they canceled it.
Can I make an anecdotal side note about the viewership of Star Trek?
Go ahead.
I work for a science museum, and there's an astronaut named Mae Jemison. Jemison or Jemson, and she was the first African-American woman in space. And she said that seeing Uhura on TV when she was a little girl inspired her. And so she's made contact with that actress. Who's the...
Michelle Nichols.
Michelle Nichols. She said they made contact, like, they know each other now. And she was like, thank you for, you know, showing me that a woman especially a woman who looks like me, could be an astronaut.
Keep throwing facts out like that throughout this podcast, and we will be golden.
Yeah. Well, and that kind of leads into like what I think is important about the series, is that it starts from the premise that humanity has resolved all its issues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no more racism, there's no more poverty, there's no more war among humans. Like, we have somehow all figured out how to get along, and now the challenges relate to people who are outside of humanity. And I think it sets up the idea that, like, it's possible for us to get past all the issues that were going on in the 60s. Mm. The Cold War, civil rights issues, labor versus industry issues. The idea that, like, we can get past this, and we can be, as a people, the ones who set the example. We can have this noble ideal, and then we can go out and, like, show other people how to get things together. Which, of course, is led by Americans from San Francisco.
Hey, we're going to do it.
Right.
No, that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up. Like, it was a very optimistic view of the future. And I'm not very familiar with science fiction up until that point. I don't know if that was against the trends, or if science fiction up until then was, you know, the future was not going to be a good place.
I mean, it kind of went both ways. There was a lot of like, our technology is going to overtake us, mm-hmm. and be our downfall. You know, like, robots and weapons are going to destroy humanity.
But Star Trek did not subscribe to that.
Not universally, there are definitely episodes.
Yeah,
there are. But what you were speaking about from, like, its starting point.
Right, the idea that, like, decent, well-intentioned people who have society's best interests in heart will eventually win out.
And that is all Gene Roddenberry, I believe. That was his idea. He was a big believer in the hope of humanity, and humans will tend to do the good thing in the future. I see you smirking over there. You want your zombie apocalypse. It's coming, sir.
Oh, Roddenberry, you fool.
All right, so, Kitten.
Yes.
Let me jump over to you. So, what are your impressions of the show? What do you remember about the show?
I grew up watching it. I come from a family of Trekkies, so it was always sort of one of those things in our household, which is how I saw the entire series when I was very, very little, because, hey, Star Trek's on TV. Everything in the house comes to a stop, and you sit down and watch Star Trek.
Let me ask you, did you watch this first, or had you experienced another Star Trek series, notably Next Generation?
Oh, no, because I watched this in the 70s.
Okay.
So all your new stuff didn't exist. And actually, when the new series started coming out, I was a little bitter.
All right.
No, it won't work.
So this was your first experience with Star Trek.
It was. Okay. And it was not only the series, but it was a lot of the fandom, because we went to a lot of the Star Trek events. And we sort of stumbled into one by accident when we were at a Red Lobster in Albany, Georgia. And in the back room, the local Star Trek fan club was having a meeting, and they're all like in their Star Trek uniforms and everything else. And this is, I think I was like 6 or 7 years old when this happened. And my parents were rabid about it. They're like so excited. And we went back and joined them and got involved. And Albany was an hour and a half from where we lived. So we were going, my parents were loading us up in the car and driving once a month, an hour and a half to Albany to take part in a Star Trek fan club. Wow. So yeah, this was sort of my roots. And you know, granted, when I was a kid watching it, it was just like, you know, American cowboy in space gonna go out and, you know, make the rest of space palatable for humanity. And I got a little bit of my parents' like hippie political influence of things, being like, that's just like America. We're going to go out and enforce our politics on everybody, whether they want it or not.
Hey, it's the Federation, not America. Which is Space America.
Right, Space America. And, you know, and so that was, but I didn't, again, I was like 6 or 7 years old, so I didn't fully wrap my head around that.
Right.
So when I went back and was watching a lot of these, you know, episodes as an adult, I'm like, yeah, you know, the prime directive for this is like, we're going to go out and explore, but we aren't going to interfere. And Kirk's all like, no, I'm going to interfere with everything, and I'm going to sleep with all your women, and I'm going to kill anyone who gets in my way for
That's
it.
That's what Kirk does.
That's what Kirk does. He's total, like, space cowboy in that. But I still was able to go back and see a lot of sort of that Cold War mentality, mm-hmm. Which, you know, is sort of weird to think about, because that's that's what I grew up with. You know, I grew up with the whole thing of, like, we still occasionally did bomb drills of, you know, crawl underneath your desk and put your hands over your head, because when the atom bomb hits, that'll help.
Maybe your desk is lead.
They may well have been, because we still had lead miniatures and lead paint, so before we figured that whole thing out.
Did you say you had attended a convention? Have you been?
Yeah.
Have you been to multiple Star Trek conventions?
Yeah.
Wait, they have conventions for this stuff?
Yeah.
So let's chat real quick about
of
that.
Them.
After the show went off the air, it went into syndication, and that's where it really got its huge following. Yeah. And
massive cult following.
I read an interesting quote from the Tribune. This is quotes from 1987, so I don't think it's relevant anymore. But in 1987, the Chicago Tribune said that there was not a time since Star Trek went off the air in 69, there was not a 24-hour period where an episode was not on the air.
Wow.
Like, it was on the air somewhere all the time, ever since the show went off the air.
That's impressive.
On local networks or however syndication works. And Paramount was making a ton of money. In 1987, Paramount was making $1 million from each episode in syndication.
What?
Yeah, and in 1994, although this is a long time ago, reruns were still airing in 94% of the United States. That's the original series. Huh. That's nothing else, which is really impressive.
Yeah.
So it made them a lot of money, and it built a huge fan base. And is there another show? I mean, Star Wars has conventions. Is there another thing? I mean, like, conventions are a big thing now. Did Star Trek kind of start the nerd convention?
I think so, because I think it was one of, like, I mean, there were, like, science fiction shows, you know, there was Lost in Space and a few other things, but I don't think there was anything that people quite identified with in the whole, we want to dress up like these people and go out and do this. So it started with a lot of the fan clubs, and, you know, and then it just sort of grew from there. And so many of the conventions that, you know, I still, you know, go to and work at now started as Star Wars conventions and then just sort of started Star Trek conventions.
Oh.
So yeah, they started as Star Trek conventions and then they just started adding other fandoms on top of that.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
When I think about, like, convention in shorthand, like, not nowadays because they're so popular, but growing up, if someone was like, I'm going to a comic book convention or I'm going to a Star Trek convention, I would know what that was. But if someone's just like, I'm going to a convention, I would assume it's like, oh, business stuff,
yeah,
right? So, like, comic books and Star Trek, I feel like, and I might be not accurate in this because I'm not a scholar in convention history, but I think that those two, comic books and Star Trek, were the big things, at least in the US. Maybe Doctor Who had conventions in the UK at the same time.
I don't know.
Doctor Who did have some of those, but again, I really think a lot of that, even for Doctor Who, grew out of the whole being like, hey, let's get a whole bunch of passionate people together in one place, and then, you know, and there were even Doctor Who conventions still in the United States.
Yeah,
and there were back in the 70s, because I went to some of those as well.
Get them in one place and get a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, it's I don't know how the licensing works out, but I'm assuming these conventions are just gold mines for artists, for prop, you know,
and the actors.
Property. Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, made a career out of going from city to city and signing headshots and giving little speeches and quoting lines from the show and getting their picture taken with fans.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, and it's one of those Star Trek. I feel like is one of those series that, as far as the aesthetic of it, it might not hold up.
Okay.
You know, all of our technology for being able to create film and television and all of the special effects and everything else has advanced so much that the whole, like, no, when we need to create things, you know, we need to make monsters, we actually need to make monsters. We can't just CGI everything. And, you know, so for that, you know, on that aspect, it might not hold up. But obviously, it holds up as a universe. And, you know, original series started all of this. And I think because of that, there's always going to be a fan base for that. It's always going to be something that holds up in the idea that it's going to have a perpetual fan base. And it's going to have something that keeps creating and building on itself and bringing new fans back to the original series.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you start with the idea, like, you've got the Federation, you've got the Klingons, you've got the Romulans. like, all of that came out of the first season of the show, and, like, how many movies and other TV shows have based entire plot lines around that?
Well, let me jump over to you, Pete, before we jump too far ahead. Same questions to you. What was this? Was this your first exposure to Star Trek, or were you a Next Generation kid?
I think the first Star Trek I ever watched was the first four movies.
Oh, that's interesting, because they're actually, I would argue they're very different from the show that they are based on.
I know the first Star Trek I ever saw was Star Trek the Motion Picture, which is very much like a two-hour episode of the original series.
Which is why I would argue it doesn't work, but that's a separate podcast. We'll do a Wrath of Khan and all that podcast.
But, then I saw like scattered episodes of the original series, and it's more like, it's more being a fan of the idea of that world.
Okay.
Most of what I watched growing up was Next Generation. You know, Sunday nights with the family, everybody has your grilled cheese and potato chips, and you sit around the TV and you watch Next Generation. And it's also dated in its own way. But then going back and watching the original series just in the last year, it's like an artifact from a different culture. It's very clear that people at the time were worried about very specific things. Actually, I made a list, because I, like, sorted out, like what are the things that Captain Kirk has to deal with, or, like, be afraid of and overcome? It's, like, losing his manhood, technology taking away his humanity, failing in his career.
Marrying an ugly woman.
Yeah, women, women either as ugly women or as manipulative women, politicians getting in the way of, like, real men doing their job and making the world safe.
That could be a legitimate issue.
And it's all, like... Like, it's the exploration of how are these issues legitimate. Also, like, really worried about drugs. There are a bunch of episodes where, like, somebody's on some kind of drug and it makes them, like, less able to do their job and less responsible.
That was one of the things from the original pilot of why it got rejected. Because there was a whole, like, drug subplot in there. And then there was even a later episode that was written by Harlan Ellison that Gene Roddenberry rejected huge chunks of it because it had this whole drug trafficking subplot going on, and they're like, no, not gonna talk about it, no.
That you bring up the writers. I know Gene Roddenberry had creative control, but this was one of the first shows, if my research is correct, that brought in legitimate up-and-coming science fiction writers. I'm not familiar with science fiction writers of the 50s or 60s, so And I don't know if these are mainly television people or not, and I have none of their names written down, so I totally failed as a host. But supposedly, that is true. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and I like the fact that, like, the characters are so strong as characters that a wide range of people can write for them in a way that hadn't particularly been done. Yeah,
and they wanted to. I mean, it was one of those things at the time that, you know, famous established writers, you know, again, like, you know, Harlan Ellison, even though, like, he only did one episode, but, you know, that they would come to it and be like, no, we want to write for this. We want to work on this. And you see it happening more now. Mm-hmm. But back then it was all, you know, most of these series were sort of like self-contained with their little core group of writers and developers. And so it was a nice expanse there.
So let's jump into the specifics of the show. Mark, do you have any questions so far?
I don't have a question, but I do have a thought that spawned during the conversation.
Spawn it.
Spawn. Different podcast. Yes. So two things. This is like a product of the 60s, I guess. And what you were saying, the topics they address, like racism, governmental control, that reminds me a lot of X-Men, which was coming out in that time, and it was using metaphor to deal with current issues, much like Star Trek. The other thing I was thinking is like, this series deals with those things. It's saying, we're in a utopian society. We're post-war. We're post-racism. We're post-misogyny, I guess, or chauvinism. So
sort of.
Right. The world is set in that environment, but the writers are not. And I think you see stuff like, well, maybe not the writers, but the production itself. So as I mentioned, you see all the women wearing very short skirts. Kirk bedding down every attractive alien he can get his hands
on. Because this is an ideal universe.
I mentioned I looked at Trouble with Tribbles this morning. Chekhov is like, oh, did you know a Russian man invented this? Russia is good. Back like thousands of years ago. I don't know why I care about Leningrad, because I'm a future Russian, but apparently I do. And the Klingons insult Kirk at the bar, and Chekhov goes, "Oh, those Cossacks."
Yep.
And I'm like, what?
What a dated.
How is that a relevant slur for future Russia? I guess doesn't exist because of Federation.
Maybe something happened recently with Russia in that universe.
Well, there are still
future Cossacks.
There are still like national territories and ethnicities and stuff like that. But they've all learned to get along. Uh-huh.
So let's
talk about the specifics of the show and the universe and the characters real quick. I'm a next gen kid. I was raised Next Generation. Then I watched the original series. I actually watched the movies, like you, Pete, before I saw the series. Mm-hmm. So at this time in the universe, is the Federation very prolific? Like, are there a lot of starships? Is the Enterprise the flagship? Do you guys happen to know?
No, the Enterprise was just an exploratory science vessel.
Okay.
But it's still one of only 12 ships of its type.
Right.
Wow.
It's like the biggest ship the Federation has.
Right.
Okay. According to the series Enterprise, the Enterprise was able to go farther than their other ships, the first one, right? Wasn't that the big deal about it?
Right. And, you know, because they're like, oh, now we have, like, these new, like, warp drive technologies and all that with our lithium crystals. Not dilithium yet.
Regular
lithium crystals. And, you know, but again, it was an exploratory vessel. The Federation had, like, they had a fair number of ships, mostly, like, smaller, you know, sort of, like, shuttly things.
Yeah.
And they had, like, several planets around the quadrant.
Who's in the Federation at this point? Like, obviously, humans.
There's a lot of people.
Yeah.
It was really founded by the humans and the Vulcans.
Yeah.
But there are, like, the Andorians are definitely part of it.
Those are the blue guys?
Yep.
Yes, with the guys with the stalks on their head.
And
the people at home can't see. Everybody just did little finger stalks.
Everybody, take off your headphones, do finger stalks, and put your headphones back.
Okay. They don't mention a whole lot of it, but they're constantly having to show up at, like, a Federation planet and intervene in some situation that's happening.
Okay.
You don't get a lot of, like, the details, because they're not going to make an exhaustive list, because then that's what they can do in the future.
Right.
So.
And they have a lot of planets, I think, that they go to because they're like, oh, well, these are people who we're starting to incorporate into the Federation.
Right.
And having to go in and be like, yeah, we have all of these people who are on our side for becoming part of the Federation, but then we have these people who aren't. So we have to go in and show them what wonderful Westerners we are.
Right. It's very colonial.
It is.
Well, it was really Cold War.
Yeah.
Like, is this going to be a Federation, or is it going to be a communist country?
Right.
It's really a Cold War thing. The Federation and the Klingons are very obvious stand-ins for America and Russia and all Soviet countries, and they're recruiting various planets and coming into conflict in those places by proxy.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. And the Enterprise is led by Captain James T. Kirk.
Tiberius!
I have something funny about that. He was not the original captain of the Enterprise.
Right. I saw the pilot one.
Yes.
Like, long, long ago.
With Jeffrey Hunter as Christopher Pike. And that was the pilot that they said was too cerebral. Huh. I don't know. They didn't intend to recast Hunter. He just chose not to come back. I don't know why. I don't know anything about Jeffrey Hunter.
Bad move, Hunter.
So then they brought in William Shatner. Leonard Nimoy, as far as I know, is the only cast member from that pilot with Jeffrey Hunter to stay on the show.
Majel Barrett.
And Majel Barrett was...
like the first officer or something on the show.
Oh, really? She wasn't Nurse Chapel?
No, she was like a lieutenant or something.
Yeah, she was a lieutenant, but she wasn't number one.
No, she was number two.
Right.
But like...
which is unfortunate.
McCoy was not there, Scotty was not there, like none of the rest of the cast... her and Spock. For the second pilot that they made, something interesting that I noticed, they have his name listed as James R. Kirk.
On the tombstone.
And Sulu is like a psychiatrist or something. He's not a helmsman.
He's a botanist.
Yeah. He's a botanist?
Yeah.
Yeah, they changed that up too.
Which they bring back every once in a while. They'll be like, oh, I like botany.
And swords. Oh my.
Hobby botanist.
But yeah, Star Trek primarily revolves around Kirk, Spock, and Dr. McCoy.
The three bros. Throwing it out together.
Spock represents pure logic. Generally, McCoy is the passionate one, and then Kirk kind of is the balance.
Is the penis?
Is the penis.
They're like the rat pack of space.
Thank you for taking this in a direction.
I took it in a direction, but it's a family-safe direction.
It is.
A medical word.
It is. yeah, so what do you guys feel? Let's talk about Kirk first, who Gene Roddenberry has said is Horatio Hornblower in space. I don't get that reference. Is that a... Who is that?
None of us read, like, late 1800s seafaring literature.
We need to ask my naval officer stepdad, who drinks his scotch and reads those things nonstop.
No, but he's like the heroic sea captain.
Yeah. Horatio Hornblower was very much like, I'm going to go out and explore and save the maiden and do this at the end, and... lead my merry band of other shipmen and
my shirt
keep
got
them
ripped.
Safe.
Yeah. They made a Master and Commander movie, right? With Russell Crowe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So back to Kirk.
He's the real life.
How do you guys like William Shatner as an actor and Kirk as a captain?
I like him as Kirk. I mean, I honestly, I haven't seen a lot of the other things that he's done.
Watch Boston Legal. He's really good in Boston Legal.
It's T.J. Hooker.
I've never seen TJ.
But, like, Kirk as a character a lot of times comes off really condescending to his crew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very like, oh, Spock, you don't understand because you don't have feelings. Or, like, McCoy, you need to set your emotions aside and learn to think like a real man who has responsibilities.
I saw an episode where he, like, yelled at Uhura. He was just like, that was uncalled for. Yeah. Come on. She's doing her job.
Yeah.
He comes off as a dick from time to time. And I think William Shatner / Kirk is... supposed to be in his mid-30s. I know William Shatner, I think, was 33 or 35 when he
That's
was...
That's another thing I like about this show, is these are not a bunch of 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
Well, Chekhov might be.
But they're, like, the officers in charge of the ship have been in Starfleet for, like, 20 years. More than that in Spock's case. It's been, like, 50 years.
Yeah.
Like, they are adults who have been through things and know how to deal with things, and they're still being presented with situations that are new to them. And that's what, like, I think that's interesting. It's way more interesting to watch than, like, oh, of course he doesn't know what to do. You know, he's just out of Starfleet Academy.
Yeah. Well, I think if he wants to, like, Gene Roddenberry wanted to give it, like, that military, professional
Like, you see the entire chain of command.
Yeah, like, it's... Yeah.
And I also think that was one of the differences you had for Star Trek and some of the other science fiction series, like Lost in Space, because Lost in Space was largely developed... to be a kid's show.
Yeah, you got a bunch of child leads.
Yeah, and, you know, it's all very cartoony and things like that. So, you know, with Star Trek, like, it was for adults.
This is why everyone hates Wesley Crusher.
Kirk, yeah, like, Kirk, Kirk in the series, Kirk in the movies is very different from Kirk in the series. But Kirk in the series, yeah, he is, like... you know, blow things up, gonna do what's right. He doesn't have the intellectualism of Picard. He doesn't have, like, I've gotta go the dark places that Sisko does. you know.
Play the piano. Work it out.
He is, like, the just happy go do it captain.
Well,
you know,
I mean,
he's captain.
He's a cowboy.
He is a cowboy.
He's very much a cowboy. And, you know, I like William Shatner.
I do too. I do like him.
I like him
She's
as a person.
She's probably gotten drunk with him, so.
No, but...
I've gotten drunk on him.
Yes. I think he's, you know, even outside of his character, I think, like, he's one of those people who sort of embraced the fandom and, you know, was able to sort of build, you know, this whole... Enterprise.
That's one.
There. Oh,
you're only gonna one.
Okay. You know, Strawberry Fields forever.
Right. That started there, but you know, and I think putting him in as Kirk and having that whole sort of, you know, his heart shaped face and his hairless chest and, you know, that whole borderline very masculine but still sort of androgynous. And they used to do this thing when filming him that to give him that same, like, soft blur that they gave to the females on the show, which was something they did often by just rubbing Vaseline on the camera lens.
They love doing that.
Yeah.
All those weird close-up shots with the eye light.
Right.
Yeah, like, just light on the eyes.
And I think, like, I mean, obviously, like, I can't say, oh, I don't think anybody else could have done that. But I think William Shatner has such a stylized approach to Kirk that he's what made Kirk an icon in that. Mm-hmm. And so I like Kirk as a captain, aside from the fact that the whole series was just horribly misogynistic. And of course, Kirk is the worst of all of them in that. But, you know, I like his whole sort of, you know, I'm just gonna go in and do what needs to be done and save my people and spread the word of my government because that's what you do as a captain.
Yeah.
It, you know, it maybe would really have been a different show if Christopher, or if Jeffrey Hunter had stayed on as Christopher Pike. Just because from, like, the one episode, Kirk is so different from Pike.
Yeah, he's got swagger.
Yeah, Pike is, like, really, I remember that one episode, he's really, like, morose and he's just really super serious in that one. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not saying bad things about Jeffrey Hunter. He passed away. But, yeah.
Because if he was still alive.
He was still alive. Oh. So, anything else you guys want to say about Kirk?
Yeah. Like, and I don't know if this is overlapping eras. I mentioned he and his buddies are like the Rat Pack. And I think what made me say that is like, there's this kind of thing that was happening with pop culture where you have, like, the Connery James Bond, and Frank Sinatra's awesome, and I guess that's 50s rather than 60s, but he was still around in the 60s, and then Kirk. You've got these, like, leading men alphas who are super confident. Like you said, they have swagger, they're womanizers, they're cocky, you know? And I think men saw that and were like, I wish I was like that. I want to be like that guy. He gets all the dames. Damn. And for me personally, like, I grew up, my dad loved Next Generation. And so I would, like, as a little kid, watch it with him on occasion, or Deep Space Nine. And, like, I was not a confident or cocky young man, you know? And so there's something in me that rejects Kirk, that rejects his, like, his arrogance and his disregard for other people's feelings, his sort of megalomania. I'm like, you are the bully. I like Spock.
Yeah, right.
Spock has to suffer your BS.
He is kind of a bully.
He's very
that's
much.
That's how you get things done.
Yeah, you put bullies in charge.
You
and
would
they
like
push everyone else around.
You would like movie Kirk a lot more than series Kirk. Mm. But yeah, Kitten, I have a question specifically for you. Just because I want to know.
Whoa.
Is 35-year-old William Shatner / Kirk, is he an attractive man?
Because
I feel they were trying to play up William Shatner's sex appeal.
I think they were. I think attractiveness is very subjective.
Okay.
I can see, like, in looking at the formula, I can see where he would be attractive.
Okay.
Because he was confident. He was outgoing. He was, you know, commanding. And, you know, so all of those things and looking like, you know, when people are looking for that whole, like, you know, I want somebody who's confident. I want somebody who has an assurance with who they are and what they're doing. And that's always attractive, you know, regardless of gender. Mm-hmm. But I think in him, they just, like, sort of really pushed that. Like, he basically never had any doubts about anything that he was doing. And Spock and McCoy often had to act as his conscience.
Well, mm-hmm. Do you guys mind if we drift to Spock and McCoy, or did you?
Yeah, that's cool. No, I wanted to throw in that, like, I think our idea of what is a physically attractive person has been manipulated a lot over the last 30, 40 years by movies and things. Huh. Now, if a male character in a movie is going to take his shirt off, he's going to be ripped and chiseled.
Yeah.
There were a lot of episodes of Star Trek where I think literally, like, the god Adonis had his shirt off. And his belly hung over his belt a little bit. But that was okay, because he's
okay.
Adonis.
True. Yeah. True. Yeah. Damn it, media. All right, so let's talk about Spock and McCoy, played by Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly. Both of these actors I really enjoy. I really like DeForest Kelly.
Yeah.
I like McCoy. He might be my favorite doctor in all Star Trek.
Oh my god.
Yeah, don't get me wrong, I have a crush on Dr. Crusher, but as far as, like, passionate medicine and, like, doing what's right,
right,
like, he just I don't know, I just really like McCoy. And he does it with, like, a bit of attitude too. There's this great episode, the episode with Khan, where Khan, like, holds a knife to McCoy's throat when he's, like, treating him in bed, and McCoy, like, there's this awkward pause, and McCoy's like, if you want to kill me, cut the carotid artery, like, right here on my neck, or just let me go. Or make a decision, damn it. Like, he's just fed up with... McCoy seems like he's fed up to even be on the ship. It's really funny. And then you have Spock, the super logical...
Alien,
but it's also like... And Roddenberry, you can see this throughout all the rest of the series. Like, you always have that one alien character that humanity, like, bounces against. Whether it's Spock or Data...
Right.
Or,
like, to give you a perspective on your humanity.
Yeah.
Right.
Odo, probably, for DS9.
Isn't Spock a half-elf?
I don't know. He's half Vulcan
half
and half-human.
Half-human.
Yeah.
But he's mainly Vulcan.
Right. You grew up on Vulcan, and he tries to set aside his humanity all the time.
Yeah, he went through all of the traditions of, like, the Vulcan upbringing of, like, no, this is how you manage your emotions.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, sometimes he'll freak out.
Well, once every 14 years, he has to go mate.
Oh,
Pon Farr.
Hey, I like this guy a lot.
And
that's
where
we're on the same cycle.
And I mean, not just mate, but like violently murder people.
Oh, Jesus.
Yes.
Murder
so
mate. Like fight to the death in order to win your woman.
Yep. And there was an episode for that.
So what do you guys want to say about Spock and McCoy? The other two, the two that balance out Kirk, essentially.
Awesome.
They are great. Awesome.
Some of my favorite episodes are the ones that focus on them. There's one where Spock's parents show up.
And I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, it's a really complicated, like, his dad basically hates him because he went into Starfleet instead of staying on Vulcan as part of the Science Academy. And it's this whole, it's an episode about, like, a parent coming to terms with their child's career.
Huh.
And, like, accepting the fact that he's not only Vulcan. It's a really good episode.
And human mom occasionally stepping in and going to dad and being like, you know, you can't be like that because you went against all of these things to choose me.
Yeah.
So it's on you. But yeah, I think Spock and McCoy are wonderful because they're far more three-dimensional characters than Kirk is.
Yeah.
You know, Kirk is very much the swashbuckling cowboy. Whereas Spock and McCoy do have a lot more as far as history through the show and family ties and emotional conflicts that go on for them. And they have times that they go through and do things. They're like, should we really be here? Should we be doing this? Should we be interfering with these things? And then they have times where they're like, you know, their prime directive is don't interfere and don't do this and don't do that. And they're very much like, no, we're going to do this because despite our, you know, directives, this is the right thing to do. And it's lovely to see. And I also think they're wonderful because in nerddom as it is, you so often, like, the people who are generally drawn to these things are the people who don't really do well with the mainstream. And so, you know, they have... It's a beautiful thing in being able to see Kirk, Spock, and McCoy because I think they were balanced very well in giving all of these, like, potentially, like, lonely, socially awkward, you know, insecure geeks. Each one could find a character as a role model, as somebody who they could identify with, whether it was the whole... You know, yeah, I don't necessarily do well interacting with others and all of that, so I can identify really well with Spock and his, you know, his lack of emotion and his not wanting to deal with these things. Or I do get very excited and overpassionate about things, so I can identify with McCoy. Or even the whole, I wish I was more confident and outgoing, so I can identify and want to emulate Kirk.
Their positions on the ship, too, are perfect. For their personalities, Spock being the logical one is the science officer, and McCoy being super passionate is, of course, the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good idea.
Just a nice example of, like, how you work with and get along with somebody who you constantly disagree with.
Yeah.
Like, they all really care about each other, and they risk their lives to save each other on various occasions.
And McCoy and Spock, again, like, the dynamic between the two of them is brilliant, because in so many ways, McCoy... hates Spock.
He does.
He just does not understand how one can be emotionless and controlled. No. And he doesn't understand why, given Spock's human half, he would choose to embrace his Vulcan half.
He's also surprisingly racist towards Spock, oh, where he's like, yeah, how's your pointed ear, green blood, son of a bitch? Yeah. Like, how are you on the Enterprise?
Yeah.
I thought we set aside these things.
Yeah, it's a bit, yeah, they're wonderful characters for that. So
I would argue the show is mainly, it's the three of them, it's their story. It might actually be Kirk's story, but it's about the three of them.
Well, they're the ones who are always on the coffee mug, so it must be about them.
So you've got the three white men,
yeah,
and then they're supported by a cast of ethnically interesting people.
Right.
So
here's Scotsman, the Japanese guy,
who are all,
Russian,
yeah,
and the black woman.
So horribly stereotypical.
Here's
yes,
my next question. After the big three, who is the next largest star?
Oh, I think the ship itself is really
It is. I mean, Scotty gets a big role.
Scotty does.
I'm not that interested in Scotty.
Okay.
Like, he has one or two good episodes, but a lot of times he's just the guy who's like, I don't think we can do that.
And Kirk goes, well, make it happen. He's like, no.
Like, his character gets more interesting, especially once he hit the movies.
Yeah.
They
all get
more
interesting once they hit the movies.
I like Sulu and Uhura.
I feel that they don't. And maybe it's been a while.
They're not particularly explored, but.
Yeah.
Like, they have interesting little moments of humanity.
Okay. Are there any characters that are completely throwaway?
Chekhov.
You feel Chekhov is not really
I think
explored?
He's comic relief in the series.
Okay.
What is his job?
He's a
helmsman.
And
yes,
he steers the ship.
So
yes,
here's something that was really interesting that I read, and I did not know that this was true. Sulu, or the actor that was playing Sulu, George Takei, was doing another series or movie in the second or third season, so they brought in Chekhov to be a helmsman, and after his movie was wrapped, George Takei was like on set more often, so George Takei and Walter Koenig, Sulu and Chekhov, actually had to share scripts and a dressing room,
yeah,
which I didn't know, but now it makes that Futurama episode where they have to share the script so much more funny to me. There's kind of this joke, like, Chekhov and Sulu are always together, and that's why they're both helmsmen, like, because of this scheduling conflict in one of the second seasons where the actor was busy.
I don't know if this is true. Here's another museum fact.
Ooh.
I don't know if this is true for modern naval vessels. Probably not. Or regular naval vessels that aren't submarines. But in World War II, the German U-boats had planesmen who would control whether the boat dove or surfaced. It has like flippers called dive planes, and you needed two of them to work together in tandem on these big dive plane wheels. So when I heard that, like, oh, two helmsmen, I was like, oh, cool, like the old submarine.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel I've seen the Enterprise work with just one helmsman, but they like to have two.
I feel like a lot of their bridge setup and a lot of the way ships fight, especially in the original series, is very much like 50s and 60s submarine warfare.
Huh.
Which,
you know,
that's a great
things move
place
slowly.
To pull from.
It's a lot more about like hiding and knowing where the enemy is. You know, not giving away any advantage.
Are you thinking of the Balance of Terror episode?
Yeah,
that's a great episode.
That's
this is also why Wrath of Khan works really well.
Things just don't in the new movies.
They're
very exciting, but they don't.
So back to the characters. You mentioned Sulu and Uhura. Is there a specific episode? Like, I feel Uhura, I mean, as, like a black woman, African-American woman in the 60s on a television show, like in a prominent role, is a really huge thing. I can't think of an episode, honestly, that did much with her, but it's been a while since I've seen.
There are one or two where, like, because she is in the middle of relaying all of the communications of the ship, like, she's getting all of these messages a step before they get to the captain.
True.
And, like, things affect her emotionally in a way that he can't afford to let himself be affected by them.
Hmm.
Because, like, she's not actually making the decision of, what are we going to do? What are we going to say? But she's hearing both sides of the conversation.
True.
And, you know, she's the one who has to tell people, like, no, we can't rescue you.
Yeah. I always like her reactions when Kirk surrenders, which is mainly in the movies. He's just like, we surrender, and she's like, what? What? Yeah, that's a good point. She is like the emotional buffer, since Kirk can't.
Yeah, and there are times where, like, she and some of the other lower-ranking members of the bridge crew are allowed to have an emotional reaction that, like, the main characters aren't.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So let's pull it back a little bit. Is there anything else about the characters that you guys want to touch on before we jump on to a couple other topics? You're looking at your notes over there.
I am. No, it's sad that we so neglect Scotty, but I feel like a lot of times in the series, he's just that guy on the other end of the intercom.
He's missing a finger.
Ew.
On his right hand. If you watch the show, he never, like, shows his right hand. Like, it's either hidden behind something or an object, or he's got it in a pocket. Because James Doohan was a pilot and had lost a finger in one of the wars.
Wow.
Yeah. You can see it in one of the movies. He's just blatantly holding a cup, and there's no finger right there.
close up of his
phantom finger. While we're sort of on that topic, I also love the fact that this cast just had to decide how to use all of the props and instruments that they were given.
True.
And that became the template for how that technology worked for the next 40 years of movies and TV shows.
Yeah, I mean,
like,
this...
for a transporter, you move the little slider up, and then you pull it back down.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, the original series started, like, almost all the technology that's in the rest of the series. Like, you had transporters. The transporter is probably the biggest one. You had phasers, tricorders...
Warp drive.
Did you have shuttlecraft? I think there were shuttlecraft.
Mm-hmm. They made shuttlecraft like a season or so into the series because it was too expensive to build a shuttle set.
Yeah. Yeah, everything's pretty much there. Deflector shields, like all the science fiction technology is there in the original series.
The funny thing to me, like talking about how they created this universe that then the other series had to live in, is like for the writers... they're just making this stuff up, like, and then they have a deadline, they gotta do it, you know? And then all of a sudden, like, decades down the line, that's canon. And so the future writers have to be like, how do we make these Klingons with the lumpy heads look like the Klingons who just look like a character of, like, the Manchurian from Iron Man?
Spock has so many telepathic powers in the original series.
Ooh, really?
He's constantly, like, mind-controlling guards to let them out of the cell and stuff like that.
They really dumbed that power down.
Yeah, I think they realized, like, oh, this is...
a little
some of our writers got out of hand.
This is a little too space elf.
But it was a funny thing that they would do that because so many of the episodes from the original series were like, oh no, everything's going to fall apart because now we've met this alien with mind control and we don't know what to do about it.
Yeah.
Without going back to be like... but clearly the Vulcans have this down.
Right.
They're members of the Federation. Maybe we should just ask.
And one thing we haven't really touched on are villains, which the Federation is not on peaceful... are they on peaceful terms with the Klingon Empire, or are they at blatant war at this point?
They don't deal with the Klingons much.
Do they not?
In the original series. They show up every once in a while as these, like, belligerent people who are sort of on the edges. The Romulans, they're definitely at war with.
Okay.
With the Klingons, I always got the impression that it was more like, you know, they'd been at war, and now there's just sort of... The Klingons are the new Cold War.
Yeah.
Because they have occasional points of, like, they go to a planet, and they're like, oh, there's these, you know, Klingons who've been stuck here for whatever, and now they're going to blame us for their circumstance, and now we have to fight them.
In the Tribbles one, there's a space station, and they're, like, trying to colonize the planet, and Klingons show up, and they're like, we think we should colonize this instead of you, and that Kirk is like, we gotta do it before they do it.
Yeah. The Enterprise is a garbage scout. Nope. Yeah. Bar fight. Cool, so let's take a step back. So for my experts, does this show hold up? If it does not, why does Star Wars A New Hope hold up and this does not? Is it just production value that's holding back the original series, or is it something more?
I think that's a big part of it.
Okay.
Like, especially you mentioned Star Wars. When somebody in A New Hope, which is, granted, it was made 10 years after
it was
this.
And it had a bigger budget.
You know, when they pick up a tool, it looks like a piece of machinery that was put together from a lot of little parts. It looks like something that has, like, wires and cords and obviously fits together with other things in some way. When somebody in the original series of Star Trek picks up a tool, it's a cardboard box with a couple of lights on it. Very rarely are any of their instruments labeled. So I can imagine that it would be just astonishingly confusing to use a computer on this ship.
Yes.
It's just a panel of, like, 14 lights that blink in random patterns.
Yeah.
Where's
the override? The override.
So there was very much a, like, well, just make it look futuristic.
Yeah.
And without a lot of thought to, like, oh, this needs to look like something that was designed by humans and used by humans. So I think that, for me, was a lot of what made it a tough show to rewatch.
Is there a show from this era that does hold up, or do you feel television in general, it, like production value and...
Yeah, I think it was an era when TV shows looked like theater.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's a good... That's very
especially
good point.
Star Trek. Star Trek is so much, you know, we're gonna rip off a plot line from Shakespeare and make it an episode of Star Trek. But yeah, like, we build a set, and we put the camera over here, and then our actors come out and do the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's... We've moved to a much more, like, naturalistic style of television, which probably started in the 70s and 80s, where, like, no, even our fantasy shows need to look very real. So that, like, it just becomes a distraction when you're watching an older show like that.
Okay.
Even the modern Star Trek series have, you know, they try to look real.
Kitten,
so.
What do you agree with that assessment? Do you feel old Trek holds up, or...?
It's, again, I feel like it's one of those, like, I feel like the concept holds up.
Yeah.
I feel like as an establishing baseline for a universe, it holds up. I think, again, like, you know, the technology is a large part of what makes it to where, like, new viewers, people who aren't already into some sort of Star Trek fandom, aren't going to go to original series Star Trek and be like, yeah, that.
Yeah.
And I think part of it's the technology, you know, advancements that have been made. I think part of it is, at the time, I'm fairly certain that, like, color television was relatively new. And so everything
yeah.
was like, let's, you know, let's make everything really bright
yeah.
and really
yeah.
bold.
Primary
and so,
colors.
Yeah, and so it all has, like, that sort of technicolor-y aspect to it that you don't so much see now. But I also feel like it's important to note that original series Star Trek... Like, for its technology, like, a lot of the things they were doing as far as special effects, they were really new. They were really cutting edge. And I totally looked up the names, but I feel like they deserve the nod for it, is
oh.
that Howard Anderson was the one who created a lot of the early special effects, like, the transporter effects was
yeah.
all him.
Yeah.
And that same effect has carried through
yeah.
all the series. And then Wah Ming Chan did a lot of the actual, like, set and prop pieces, as well as a lot of the character creations for the monsters.
Hmm.
So the phasers, the tricorders, the communicators. He was even the creator of the Gorn.
Yeah.
Which
is
the
lizard thing.
Yeah.
That epic fight between the Gorn and Kirk. And so, you know, and so all of that was truly commendable. And almost every single episode, there's huge chunks of it missing because of working on their special effects.
Yeah.
They couldn't get the episodes produced in time. And so they're like, oh, we just have to cut out these huge things. And they later took part of the original pilot and a whole bunch of other things with the trials for Captain Pike and turned it into this huge two-part episode to fill in a lot of those plot holes and to get caught up in their timeline of making the series, because they're like, we're so desperately far behind on things and we have all these plot holes and stuff, so let's take this and let's take all these pieces of shows that we've already made and put together this two-part episode to fix all of this.
Huh.
And so even though the technology, you know, the special effects and everything else might not hold up for modern audiences, it was really cutting edge
yeah.
for its time, and, you know, and really, you know, spectacular. And having, you know, new color television and watching something in color, it was bright and it was eye-catching and mesmerizing. And I think the other thing that makes it to where the show doesn't hold up is a lot of the politics. It is that Cold War era. It is that, you know, looking at sort of, you know, those political movements that don't so much exist anymore. And so a lot of the things that would have been really relevant as far as, like, the episode where they're dealing with Number 7 and his cat Isis, and he's like, hey, I'm going to go blow up this bomb over China to try to do this, like, you know, eco-terrorist plot line, and then that gets thwarted. And a lot of that is just, it's just not a lot of focus for modern society anymore. And so they miss those very real points that can be made from the show.
Yeah, I've got my list of episodes that I would recommend to watch, and none of them are very political in nature.
Yeah, it's the
yeah.
little, like, the close in, like, very personal human storylines
yeah.
that really hold up.
Right.
Well, that takes me into my next question then. When is Star Trek at its best, and when is it at its worst?
I love it when somebody can't do the thing that they're most passionate about. There's an episode where They go back in time, of course.
As usual, apparently.
Save a woman from being killed in a car accident.
It's one of my favorite episodes.
Which then alters history and allows the Nazis to win World War II. They have to go back in time again and allow this, like, wonderful, kind, pacifist woman who McCoy has fallen in love with.
It's Kirk. Kirk's fallen in love with her.
No, it's McCoy, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
No, McCoy saves her.
Oh, McCoy saved her, and McCoy then has to allow her to die.
Well,
As the doctor yeah. who, you know... Yeah, they just have to go back and basically kill her over again so
and
that America will win World War II.
And you're talking about the city on the edge of forever.
Yeah.
And specific... One thing I want to give props... There's this... When she dies, you don't see her die. You see, like, William Shatner watching her die.
Of course.
And there's
it's all
this,
about him.
Yeah. But I will give props to him. Like, that moment where he watches her die is great. It's really... You know, bravo to him for pulling. Like, you just see Kirk just tear apart. And, like, Spock is holding him. Or, no, McCoy is holding...
Spock's holding McCoy.
Spock's holding McCoy. I thought Spock was also holding Kirk.
Because McCoy's like, do you know what you just did?
Yeah.
And you're like,
and,
yeah,
and,
we do, actually.
Yeah.
They should have had Spock knock the two of them out with his neck pinch. And been like...
Levitate like, her with his psychic powers.
He should have been like, this must be done. I am emotionless. And just been the executioner.
No, because you gotta let people make their own decisions. Otherwise, they'll never grow up.
When is it, just to keep with you, Pete, when is it not working? When is Star Trek not working? When they go to Nazi planet?
No, Nazi planet was pretty good. It doesn't work for me when the plot line revolves around something that, like, we as a society have gotten past. When, like, the plot is, oh, this woman is too ugly and career-driven. Yeah. We can't let the captain fall in love with her.
So in
you know?
Anything with, like, Harry Mudd, you're just not on board with.
His first episode, I think, was pretty bad. Because it revolves around the fact that, like, women were pretending to be beautiful in order to trick men to marry them.
Right.
Oh, worst possible.
But then they're going to trade the women for technology to fix the ship. And once they do that, once he arranges all of that, Kirk still goes and turns them in to, like, space police.
Of course.
Because he's a jerk! Oh.
But yeah, there are some episodes that are just not good.
Kitten, same question to you. When is the show working and when is it not?
The episodes for me that, like, I'm much more on board with are the episodes that are more political. You know, dealing with Assignment Earth, which is with Seven and Isis. In dealing with Ultimate Computer, which is sort of like looking at the aspects of unmanned drones in warfare and the way they could go horribly awry. But I feel like for somebody just going and watching the series and not being into Star Trek at all, I feel like they should go more for some of the sillier kind of mind control episodes and things like that. Because it is... Just because of the aesthetic of the show from when it was made, being all clunky technology and brightly colored,
what?
I think
the Gangster Planet episode.
Right, Gangster Planet is awesome. But I think if you start looking at some of the ones of, like, Seeds of Paradise, where Spock gets infected with these spores that make him fall in love, and then, you know, Kirk has to anger him to the point that, you know, the adrenaline pushes the spores out of him. Seeing the episode of Mirror Mirror, which again, the whole, like, super silliness.
Evil Kirk.
Right! I mean, like, all of that stuff that's just super campy. Daggers of the Mind. Which, you know, you get Sulu sword fighting. Come on!
Wasn't that Naked Time?
That was Naked Time.
Oh, sorry,
that
was Naked Time. Yeah.
Naked Time.
So those.
But like the one where like Kirk and Abraham Lincoln have to team up to fight
like yes,
all
I
the evilest villains
one.
Of the universe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so bad.
You know, and so I think those are great. But I think if you're gonna like if you want to watch some of the ones being like I want to understand a little bit more of just the Star Trek universe and, you know, the way original series works in with everything else. Clearly you need to watch Space Seed, because that's the introduction of Khan and Botany Bay and all of that.
City on the Edge of Forever.
City on the Edge of Forever.
Balance of Terror.
Balance of Terror.
Mm-hmm. I would say. The Devil in the Dark, I also thought was a really good like monster murder mystery, but then brings in some nice humanity.
Oh, right, yeah, that's the
it's the creature in that, yeah, the pizza creature.
So those, like, again, like I said, you know, just depending on what you're gonna go watch it for,
yeah,
those are the things.
Are there any other episodes you would recommend to someone?
Not off the top of my head. I feel like when I was watching it, like, when you hit season 3, the series starts to be less about, like, what crazy thing can we put in this episode, and more about, like, what's an interesting story that we can tell with these characters.
Yeah. All right. We've got to kind of wrap up here.
Are you going to watch it all?
Are you going to watch all these episodes now?
They're all on Netflix.
They're all on Netflix.
No, I'm not going to do that.
Oh, we have failed.
I have 4 more seasons of Supernatural to work through.
Technically,
sorry, bros.
One.
Walking Dead.
So, Mark, do you have any questions so far? Any observations?
I feel like I've vented most of my spores. one thing... I'm discovering, like, as a consumer of sci-fi, lifelong consumer of sci-fi and fantasy, really, the older I get, the less I tolerate camp. And I think it's a very polarizing thing. I think some people really celebrate campiness. And I think the trend in modern, like, sci-fi stories and media is to be more, like, gritty and realistic, like a Nolan-esque type situation. And I don't know, because I love comedy, I love laughing, but in my sci-fi, I always want it to be deadly serious. I want there to be a lot of, like, heartbreak and high emotional stakes.
Because it's science!
I think you can do it every once in a while.
It's the core logic of science.
Which, for me, is why Star Trek IV, the movie, really works. It's because you had 3 years of series, which were pretty serious. And then you had, like, 3 movies, which were about, like, destroying the world.
Life and death.
Like, close friends getting killed and, like, vengeance for past wrongs. And then you have this movie where people from the future come back to the 80s.
You really needed... That series really needed that at that point.
It was just, a great little, like, reset. Like, yeah, we like these characters. Like, they are our friends. They've been part of our lives for 20 years now. Let's just have a fun movie.
So. Real quick, any big differences that you guys want to point out between Star Wars and Star Trek, specifically original series and the original trilogy, perhaps, even though it came 10 years later?
Right. I think
like Trek is the more cerebral show, and I want to.
Well, and Trek is not just action.
No.
And magic. It's technology and exploration and diplomacy.
I think, like, it's a little bit apples and oranges, because Star Wars are movies, Star Trek was a series, and like you said, the budget is vastly different, or at least the quality of the props and stuff, and also Wars is, like, a story about basically the single hero's journey, coming to terms with, like, having to face a challenge, and then in the subsequent movies... the family stuff and, like, feelings of betrayal and stuff like that, whereas Star Trek had to wrap up everything after, like, what, 45 minutes
into
a little package, and you don't have there are the political episodes where it's not based on the character's emotional journey so much as we got to solve this external problem.
One thing about the show wrapping up, like, I wish, I maybe it's just been a long time since I've seen the show, I wish things in episodes carried over to other episodes. Like, there's things that happen in Next Generation that stick with those characters, and that may just be the style of television, is we keep plot lines
going. Yeah, it happened occasionally.
In the original
series. Like,
they would
bring a character back, or they would discuss, like, oh, on that planet before, you were affected in this way.
Okay.
But you just... I just don't think you saw it a lot. And I also think it was a time that, more often than not, like, when series came out, you didn't always have the whole, we're going to go ahead and option this for X number of episodes. Like, they were perpetually on the edge of being canceled.
Yeah.
So they sort of kept that whole, you know, everything was sort of its own, you know, bubbled in story for things.
And there's no, like, end to the series.
No.
It's just another episode, and then there aren't any more.
No. Well, then the movies eventually.
Yeah.
I will say, I've met more women who are fans of science fiction who like Star Trek way more than Star Wars. And their argument to me has always been that Star Wars is a boys show. Not that it's bad, but there's just not much... There's not as much there for a woman as there is in Star Trek.
Yeah, really, when it comes right down to it, There's no women in the Star Wars universe.
Not really.
There's Leia. She's obnoxious. there's basically nothing that's redeeming about her. You just want to slap her and shove her back into the garbage scow. whereas Star Trek, you have Uhura, who, you know, is...
Who works the phones.
Well, you've got
reception or some space.
Chapel, and then who is... A counterpart to McCoy.
Yeah, and you have, even though a lot of women do become disposable characters and get tossed to the side, you do have, you know, a lot of, you know, women in episodes who are, you know, doctors and military leaders and, you know, and
they
political
all
leaders.
Dated Kirk 20 years ago.
Many of them did. No, one or two of them dated McCoy.
True.
Yeah.
You got one or two dating McCoy.
But that's not a real woman. It's this salt vampire.
Oh.
But, the other episode I saw.
Spoiler alert.
So you have, like, you just have a lot more intelligent, productive women in Star Trek than you do in Star Wars. Okay. And they're given featured, prominent roles for that. Maybe not through the whole series, but at least episode by episode. And despite the overall misogyny of the series, because almost every woman who comes in, like, has her whole, like, whatever she's doing inevitably gets foiled because of her romantic or sexual involvement with one of the men, but they're still there, and that's nice to see. And a lot of science fictions and a lot of geekdoms overall don't incorporate women in that way. They're there purely to be sex symbols and damsels in distress.
It's gotten better.
It's getting there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the franchise as a whole
has gotten
definitely like progressed in terms of like the way they deal with race and gender. I think it's at the point now where on a Star Trek show, any race and any gender could fulfill any role on a ship. And it's much more going to be dependent on the individual actor to make that work.
Although Janeway is still, like, the most useless of the captains. They still haven't quite gotten that.
Meanwhile, back to the original series. So we're at 1:15. I need to go on and wrap it up. Guys. Any final thoughts or anything else you want to say about Star Trek before we hit the warp drive and take us out?
I think it's all been said.
Great. Mark, any final thoughts from you, my outcast?
I have a plug that could tie
into I'm going to get to the plug. All right, do you guys have anything you wish to plug? Any other podcasts or whatnot?
Yes. I do a fake science comedy podcast called Blastro Podcast, and I encourage your listenership to check it out if they're so inclined. In episode 4, we talk about fear, and we use the characters of the original Enterprise as metaphors for parts of the human brain and how they react when we feel fear.
Cool. Right. Pete, Kitten, do you guys have anything you want to plug?
No, sadly, I have nothing going on.
It's the holidays. Yeah. They're coming up.
Depending on when you're listening to this, if it's early enough, opening on October 29th and running through December 1st of 2013. You can see me at Chicago Dramatis in the world premiere stage production of Blackula, where I play Van Helsing.
Ooh!
Ooh. Starting in November of 2013, you can also listen to me as the co-host on the News Tech podcast, where we talk about different pieces of science and technology and things like that.
Cool.
And you can see that at discreetfx.com/newstech.
Excellent.
Cool.
I have a comedy film coming out in a few months called The F-Men, low-powered superheroes, high-powered comedy. I also have a second podcast
that goes on the poster right there.
There also might be a second podcast in the works, which I'll tease right now and tell you more about later.
About maximizing your D&D character.
It's going to be about maximizing your D&D character. If you have any comments, questions, or protests, or suggestions for topics, please email them at nerdoutcastpodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, rate us on iTunes. That pushes us up in search engines, which is great. If you didn't like the show, rate us highly. That pushes us up in search engines. I can't say that word.
You
can't.
Search engines.
I can't. Search engines. Rate us favorably. Thank
Search
you.
Search Laven.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming out tonight and talking with me about Star Trek. There will be podcasts about the movies. Don't worry, they are coming. I have been your host, Chris Bashan, and my guests today have been
Kitten McCreary,
Pete Navis,
Mark Soloff.
Thank you, and have a good evening.